Today's December 21st, 1986. My name is Steve Frangos. This is Bureau of Florida Folklife. And I'm with Mr. Walter Mann on his ranch, the MJ Ranch, and we're...
Walter Mann Training Stable.
Walter Mann Training Stable, that's where we're at now. And we're talking about bull whips and stuff, and I just wanted to turn the machine on so I make sure I wouldn't miss anything.
All right. Number one, the most important part about a whip is the balance. If a whip is not plaited properly and tapered down just right, then it's like having a piece of limp rope in your hand. It's just not going to work for you. Mm-hmm. And in order to make, say, a 10-foot whip, you have to start out with a what's called a plaited belly in there. And it will be somewhere like 3 to 4 feet long. And then you take and plait over the top of it again. And each one of these bellies that you put in a whip to kind of determine the length of it has to be balanced up, coming on down, tapering the large at one end and taper right down to a fine string at the bottom, in order to keep your whip balanced so as it'll pop and handle properly. And most of the time, the top plait on, say, a 10-foot whip will start out with an 8 plait at the top, and then it will taper on down as it gets closer, 2/3 of the way down the whip. Then, as you see here, this is a difference. See where it starts into here and goes into a 6 plait as it drops and tapering on down. And then from the 6 right through here, then it turns back into a 4. See how much closer knitted the plait is.
That's right.
And it goes right on down, tapering down just like a snake similar is made. And it gets down to the fine tail end of the whip. Then you put a 6 to 8 inch cracker, piece of buckskin, or sometime they'll use nylon strings, put a cracker on the end of it.
Now, as you're going through this, Walter, as we're talking about, now I know on a hammer that there's different names, you know, like for the head and the claw and the heel and all that kind of stuff. Now, for a whip, from the wooden handle over, you know, down to the, as you're seeing the cracker on the end here, are there distinct parts? Now, I know you're saying here about the belly, but you know what I'm saying?
Not basically. It's not, because it's just going to start out larger at what I would always term as the head of the whip, which would be next to the handle, and then down to the tail of the whip where you tie the cracker on. And as a rule, I've always been told for the length to get the proper handle put on a whip also matters whether or not it's going to handle right. And you want an inch of handle for each foot of whip that you've got, plus normally like a 2-inch head on top of the handle where the strings come through the top of it. But this in turn usually then gives the right amount of leverage to be able to handle the whip comfortably without straining yourself trying to make it work. But most people will fight a whip too much instead of letting the whip, if it's plaited right and balanced right, you can very easily throw the curl in the whip and then it pops itself. You don't have to sit here and snatch and jerk. I guess what tears them up. But if you let a whip pop itself, it'll last an awful long time, and it does the job properly.
Now, we were talking earlier, and we were talking about ranching and cowboy work that was surrounding these parts here. What would they use as just like a regular day? How would they use the whip?
Well, it was a very important tool, mostly whenever it was the bigger places were all more or less rough woods. A cowboy could ride through and pop his whip occasionally, and it would scare the cattle enough and make them go ahead and trot in front of him until they'd all get together and go to bunching them up. And a lot of times, too, it would let the other cowboys know where each other was at. And then, of course, you're always going to have some little mama cow that's got young calves or something, or an old bull that bows up and gets mad and don't want to go. And they would take the cow whips in and pop him and tap him on the ears and around on the rump wherever they could reach him with a whip, and sting him enough, he would turn in and go on and try to get in the herd of cattle. And then, of course, a lot of people would use the whips in order to control the dogs, because the noise will go further than what you could holler. And if a lot of times they want their dogs to come back off of the cattle or something, they'll be out there barking and holding cattle up. They can pop their whip, the dogs quit and come right back to the owner, you know. But it's been a very important tool for the cowboys since the beginning of time with cattle in this area that I know of.
Now, when you say they would call back the dogs, was there like a pattern to the cracking so that it would like, or the popping so that it would?
No, sir, it's mostly just the noise of the whip. They would send the dogs out and hold a bunch of cows up, all the cows would rally. And the dogs would be working around the cows to stop them running away from the riders, you know, because basically the cattle was pretty wild.
Yeah.
And the dogs would hold these cattle up so you could drive and contain the cattle where you wanted to go. And if the cattle were held up and staying still and easy, quiet, settled in the bunch, then they'd call the dogs back to let the cattle be a little quieter and gentle down for them. And so they would ease on up there close to the cattle, pop their whip quietly, and the dogs all quit and comes right back to them. If you've got 7 or 8 dogs working around, say, 100 head of cows out there, it's pretty hard for one man, and that's usually who controls the dogs in a bunch of cows, you know, it's the one owner of the dogs. And he couldn't get around to holler at all of them, but yeah. He could pop a whip, and all the dogs would hear that whip pop, and they would quit and come back to him.
Now, realizing that the times have changed, does anybody work cattle like that anymore? They probably couldn't, could they?
Oh, yes, sir.
They do?
Yes, sir. Near about every cowboy that I know of just about has a whip tied onto a saddle. So then they do the same thing with
Same process.
The same thing. They'll ride through the hammocks or something other and can pop a cow whip. The cattle trot on out in front of him, get on the outside and go to bunching up. And the majority of them still control the pack of dogs the same way. They can pop the whip and the dogs quit and come back to them. But about every cowboy around has got a cow whip tied on their saddle.
And we were talking earlier, before we had the machine on, that now the material that the whips are now made of that the cowboys use is much different. And that, again, is because of, you know, wear and tear and stuff.
Sure. All of the first whips that I was ever played with, my daddy had when I was just a little kid, and even like the whip I'm holding here, the whole cow whip is made out of buckskin. And it's pretty hard to keep them to last for years where you're out in the woods and it's wet, raining, and dragging them through the woods as you ride along on your horse to keep from cutting what's called a tail out of the whip. Down at the small end there, it'll get wet, the strings become real slippery, they'll untie or break, cut on palmetto fans and things like this. And so the majority of them just out of necessity, the whips today, most of them are made out of nylon string or something, and therefore the weather don't affect them.
Mm-hmm. But they're still plaited, or they're still braided the same way?
Exactly the same thing. They start out with one belly inside, determining the length of the whip, and then they come back and cover over that that's plaited up and looks identical as what the buckskin whips do, only they're just made out of nylon string.
And Walter, how did you learn how to first make whips? We were talking about this earlier, but
yeah. It's just was something as a kid I played with. So of course I was always tearing up the bottom end of the whip, snatching the tail out of it. And my daddy got tired of coming in. He'd whip me a few times about it. So his brother, Uncle Paul, said there's no need of you keep getting a whipping because I know you're going to keep playing with a whip. So he sat down there one afternoon and showed me how to start out with a four-plat. And so it wasn't too long after that then that I got where I could repair Daddy's whip before he would get home and tear my tail up again, you know. And so from there then I decided, well, if it's that easy, I think I'll just have to try one of them. And they gathered me up some buckskin, and I worked probably all close to a month. Come in after school and what have you, and the first thing I do is go to the barn and go to platting on a cow whip. And I had the awfulest looking piece of rope made up you ever seen. And I'd have to tear it up, start all over again. And I finally got it down after, at least 2 months of working on this whip. I finally got it down to where I could fairly well pop it around some and then come back and started rebalancing the whip and found out then out of trial and error that if it doesn't taper down properly all the way down, it's sure not going to work right. But if you can get your balance platted in there right, then it works easy. But from there, then it just come into the just something that you did. I mean, you just different ones would come around and say, oh, boy, I sure wish I had my whip fixed, and therefore I'd offer to go ahead and fix a whip for them, you know. And we got where we was repairing an awful lot of cowboys.
Yeah, because I was going to ask you about that, because if you're, I mean, a man's working, he's always going to have to, there's wear and tear on his tool. I mean, you know, he's just
that's
out
right.
there all the time. It's just
that's
like,
right.
that's the way it works.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to say how, if the cowboys themselves would fix it, or if they knew somebody who was good at it, or even with the nylon ones now, they must be tearing them up
it
sometimes.
It has to go back to the same thing. They've either got to carry them back, but the majority of them today, the cowboys today, they can, if they happen to tear just the very end of the whip up somehow, they can retwist and tie the knot right back on the whip. But before, whenever we was repairing quite a few whips scattered around, you found out pretty quick who was letting the whip pop itself and who was snatching their whips to tear them up. And those that were letting the whips pop themselves, you'd go back and put a real nice fine tail in the bottom of it, and really the whip could pop and work super easy. And then those people that was snatching the ends out of the whips, then you left them pretty heavy and blunt on the end, and it saved an awful lot of repair time. But the true, real good cowboys that would use it like a fine tool is what it is. Yeah. You could put a fine tail in the bottom of it, and it would last them a long time.
Yeah, we were also mentioning earlier, too, about plaits, and about 4-plait and 6-plait and 12-plait. Now, mm-hmm. What is that actually? Is that just so that it's the length of the whip then?
Basically, yes. Because if you're going to make, the majority of whips are 10, 12 feet long. Because they're that much easier to handle, quicker to coil up and tie back on your saddle and this kind of thing. But like my daddy's cow whip, it was somewhere close to 14 feet long. Wow. And in order to cover that big a head on top of your whip, as big around as the top of it was to taper down, then his started out like a 16 plait, and then it, as it goes down, then it graduates down from 16 to an 8, 6, 4, and then down to your twist and the tail of it. And but that's the reason for the different amounts of string that you start with, determining the size of the whip you're trying to cover.
Well, it's sort of strange for me. Can I hear you pop one?
Well, sure. And again, like we discussed earlier, too, mm-hmm. on the handle length of your whips, the majority of them are made out of hickory.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
so as it would be a heavy and a very firm kind of a wood, you know, you wouldn't have to worry about it cracking and breaking while you're working in the woods with it. But as a rule of thumb, on a normal plaited whip, you take 1 inch of handle per foot of cow whip, plus normally a 2-inch head on it where your strings go through and tie out on each side of the handle. But that usually is a rule of thumb. Now some whips require a little more handle or handle better with a little less handle, depending on, again, on the weight also of that piece of wood that you're using. But as a rule of thumb, it's 1 inch of handle to a foot of cow whip.
All right,
I'll try to pop it out here this morning.
All right.
That's over in any place where there's a little bit of timber, then it sounds similar to a shotgun going off and will carry right
farther,
on through.
I was going
to
say,
along in the 60s, we were working on a ranch up in Kissimmee, and it was the prettiest sound in the world. We'd all get to playing, driving a bunch of cattle along, and you pop. Each one would take turns popping the cow whips, and you could hear it going from one cypress head and just pop and sound like a rifle going off right on, you know, just as it float off through the different cypress heads. But that's what they were used for, though. It's basically is to gather your cattle with and to handle the dogs and stuff as you're going along with them.
Did they ever use the whips for anything else?
The only other thing they would have used them for, and it was a different kind of a whip, was driving ox team. Then as they would come along, my grandfather, that's what they used. But they used a shorter whip with a long handle. It'd have like a 4 or 5 foot handle on a shorter whip, similar to what we term now as buggy whips. But they would use that and reach out and tap their oxen with them, you know, to make the oxen drive along with the same type of thing. Now, in fact, that's one of the probably is one of the ways that it got its name that we call it today as a cow whip, because the oxen was a cow, you know, and you'd spank him a little bit to make him go ahead and pull on that wagon.
Yeah. Now, how many would you say now, and this is a guesstimate because, you know, in the county here around where they work on cattle and stuff, how many men would you say there are who still know how to, like, plait the whips and stuff?
Lord, I don't know. They would...
I know, it's kind of a tough question.
I'd say right here they would probably be 50, 75 cowboys around it would know something similar about how to go in repairing a whip, and I don't say make a cow whip, but as far as keeping their whips up and keeping them going, I'd say there'd be probably 75 of them around.
You know, I also wanted to ask you, Walt, we were talking here before, where were you born?
Little place over in Polk County called Bradley Junction.
Bradley Junction.
Yes, sir.
And you were born 1936.
Right. February the 6th, 1936.
Is your family also from Florida?
Yes, sir. My mother and father are both natives right here off Florida. And I married a Florida girl and raised up the children and stuff. Everybody's born and raised right here in Florida.
Are your grandparents originally from here? Are they from Georgia?
Came and was drifted down in here from Georgia. That's where they came from, South Georgia.
Now this is, and this goes with the bullwhips too.
Mm-hmm.
I'm from Chicago, you know.
Right.
And I had always understood that the term cracker was not, you know, complimentary.
Mm-hmm.
And then I came down here and I've been told that the term is complimentary. It can be. I mean, it's like any other name, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But that it came from cracking bullwhips and stuff like that. Is that your understanding of it?
Yes, sir. That's exactly the way that I always heard it. And but most people like myself, I'm kind of proud to be a cracker. You know, we have an awful lot of...
I think so. History and stuff.
Yeah,
I think so.
And this is our heritage, you know. It, and so we're all of us are pretty proud to be called a cracker. But that, that was always... was what the terminology that we had always heard about it was. And basically, when they first started into down here, of course, all the cattle down here was just running loose and wild because there's no big ranchers at that period.
Mm-hmm.
And the people driving their oxen coming down was cracking the whips and bringing the oxen along. So they then they found out that it would work pretty good on the oxen and it sure worked good on wild cow, make them move around, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it just went from handling the oxen over to everyday tool for the cowboy.
Can I take some pictures of it?
Sure.
All right. Sometimes I feel like I'm asking questions here in the blind, Walter.
Mm-hmm.
I wish I knew more to focus in on. I'm going to use two different types here. Make sure I get the right thing on one and the other. Is there any other kind of... work now in the area that requires any kind of like like saddle making or any of that other kind of stuff in the area that you know of, or is that more? A lot of that stuff has gone the way of being bigger and commercial, so that you know companies generally do that.
That's
rather
right.
Than
there's there's a lot of people around that are still doing repair, but there's not too many people left that custom makes your saddles. There's a place down in Lake Worth called McClellan's that still make, but it makes a lot of handmade saddles,
mm-hmm.
and made special order saddles, in just any way that you want it made. But it is a company, and it's not like one individual sitting in the back room somewhere that is just making up a saddle.
Mm-hmm.
For one thing, it takes an awful lot of time involved. And most people, when they want a saddle, it's kind of like going to town for a pair of boots. You know, you want them right then, and you don't want to wait on them. And whereas it's going to take a lot of times up to 6 months for a person to be able to build from start you a saddle.
Yeah.
Because he's got to order in the special tree that you want and then get all this leather and start out with it. And it's just going to take quite a time for you to get it put together. There was a man that we used to get all our saddles from that he's passed away now in Kissimmee, Mr. Floyd Lingle.
Floyd Lingle?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got one of his saddles here in the barn right now that I've been riding since 1963. But it's still almost as good now as it was whenever he made the saddle, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I have wore out other saddles in between. I've still got the one that he made. But it is an art that really is getting away from everybody. It's just like everything else, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's just gone pretty much commercial on more factors.
Well, one of the things that they were saying, you know, I was trying to do some reading, getting some kind of background and understanding for the story when I first came down. And one thing, everything, all the written stuff kept pointing out was that, I guess, Florida was settled after the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
More, you know, I mean, there were people here before that,
yeah.
But mostly. And that, consequently, that's at the same time that the Industrial Revolution took off.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, stuff buying from the store,
yeah.
was more accessible than anything else.
Right.
And given the hard, as you were saying earlier before Duke, that this was really a hard area to be in.
Yes.
So that what people had to do was just keep going, you know,
that's
rather
right.
than anything else. So
that's
it was easier and cheaper in the sense of time and effort,
mm-hmm.
to buy things rather than make them, unless they were like, you know, smaller,
mm-hmm.
items.
Right.
So, but I've been checking around just to see what was going on and who was doing what.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, of course, just like with my daddy, his saddle. I believe it was a Hamley saddle, and I believe he finally saved up enough money and got one shipped to him from Oregon, I believe is where they were made. Mm-hmm. And he rode that saddle in as long as he was still cowboy after he bought it, you know. But there was, other than that, people just sure didn't have money enough to buy anything at all. I mean, whenever he was foreman of Kibler Ranch over, he was making $2 a day and furnishing his own horses to ride and feeding them. And the cowboys was making $1.50 a day and had to furnish their own horse and feed them too. And so you just didn't have any extra money to go out and pay $50 or $100 in for a brand new saddle. And the majority of cowboys was riding what was called the old Army McClellan tree saddle, because they could get a hold of those pretty easy. And it was not the most comfortable thing in the world to ride, but at least they had them a saddle to be able to ride with.
And where did these saddles come from?
It was Army reject saddles, you know, that they'd used during the Civil War and stuff on the Army horses. But that's what the majority of cowboys used along then, was the old McClellan tree saddle.
What's it like now? I know, you know, times are changing and people are thinking different, and there's different ways to make a living and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But what's the general attitude about cowboys? I mean, are they still well thought of, or, you know, it's good for a while, or,
well,
or just people? Or
I think it, if anybody ever thinks about where, instead of just going to the supermarket and being able to go in there and pick up a steak, if they think about where it comes from, they have to really respect the cowboy. And it for sure is not becoming a lost art. It is a different kind of cowboy today than what it was years ago. Because when you was a cowboy years ago, you didn't do anything but ride a horse and look after cattle. And so like everything changes, today a cowboy may be driving a tractor half the time and then working the cattle the other half the time, you know, because it's just something you got to do in order for the rancher to try to survive.
Yeah.
And but no, I think that you still have to respect the cowboy a great deal.
Now, and this is all average stuff, and this is all sort of guessing, but in this county here or around here,
mm-hmm.
how many ranches would you say have, what's the average number of cowboys to a ranch? Is there any way to say that, or is that just not the way to look at it?
Depending on the size of the ranch, of course, is what's going to determine that.
Yeah.
But I'd venture to say that they've got at least four per ranch working. Now, there's some places I know where the crew, which would be the everyday people working there, they only may have two people, say, on 3,000 acres. They would maybe only have two people working, steady employees. But then when it comes time to pen their cattle and to work those, then it go and hire what's called day help to come in and help them until they got through working their cattle, and then it would be back then to the two employees for the normal year-round work on there. But overall, I would say that the majority of them have it somewhere at least four.
Mm-hmm.
Because any time that you go to work any amount of cattle, it's going to take close to four people to have a good crew. And four people that understand how to work cattle can work an awful lot of cattle in a short time.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, is there any way to again, guesstimate or estimate how many cattle those four people be working on?
Well, most of the time, a set of cow pens normally, well, they've got their pastures and their cow pens are pretty much worked up together to where they can go and like gather up one herd of cows out of a pasture. And on a decent sized ranch, they're going to have, say, around 200, 250 head of cattle in this one pasture. And so the cow pens are designed to hold pretty easily and comfortable this amount of cattle. And the four men can go out and can hold up these cattle, drive them where they need to go, put them in the pens, and the four men can work them real easy. You know, so.
But is that 200 like per pasture? Is that 200 for the ranch, or how does that?
No, that would be. I think the probably the what the ratio between cattle and land. What they used to try to do it, and again, grasses are changing, so you can run more cattle per acre.
Yeah.
And but there for a long time it was to be able to run cattle year-round without too much help during the wintertime, they figured like one cow to 4 or 5 acres of land. Now, there's an awful lot of places today that has got that down to like one cow to the acre. because of the access to so much more improved grasses than what there was, better irrigation on the pasture so they can grow that. We've got the longest, best growing season anywhere in the country. And so in order to modernize and be able to stand the cost of living increases and stuff on for everyone, they've had to go to something like this in order to stay in business. But they have got it down a lot of places to where they're running, say, a cow every 2 acres average, and you're doing it year-round like this. But that's just due to your better grasses and all, where you produce more tonnage of grass per acre than what we used to do.
Do you have any sense now, of course, the coastline is growing like hell here in the state, both sides. But do you have any sense, are the ranches holding their own? Are they getting bigger, or are they just...
Most of them are getting smaller. Due to the increase of taxes, and the value of the land has gone up so high that there's no way that you can produce that much cattle for what the land is worth off of it. So a lot of them have been sold out for subdivision land, or broke it up into smaller places, you know, because there's just no way that they could ever get that much money off of it by running cattle on it. And the whole thing, if our taxes keep a going, the whole thing is going to kill all the ranches, because there's just no way they can afford to
make a profit on,
it all. And basically, it is due to taxes that is causing a lot of the ranchers to sell out. And of course, you go right back. They, you know, it's supply and demand. It's on the other side, not just taxes. But then, if you don't get enough per pound for your beef at the market, then you're hurting all over again, you know. But there's just, people can survive as a rule the market if you don't have too much other hidden expense on your land, such as your taxes.
Yeah, it seems to me to be it's just a real waste, because, you know, it's like this whole thing about farmers or ranchers and stuff like that. They're not supporting the people. I mean, who's going to produce this stuff?
That's right.
You know, I mean,
that's
more people in the cities now than there are out here.
That's right.
So, I mean, who's gonna generate this? We can't all buy everything from the Japanese. What the hell?
Yeah.
You know, what if the Japanese close the door?
That's exactly right.
Makes no sense.
No, and it's funny. I just watched on television last night, and they had somewhere, Kansas, Oklahoma area, somewhere out there, they was showing where they were putting in a great big irrigation system on this desert-type country. And the farmers started out of wanting this thing, and then they found out just what it was going to cost. And after they done got started into it, and then a lot of them decided, well, there's no way I could ever pay my share if I tapped into this thing and get to using it. And the whole kicker of the whole thing was, when they was closing off there, that why was the government spending so many millions of dollars of putting in this irrigation system, when they were turning around and in other areas was paying out so many millions of dollars not to produce this kind of stuff, you know? So somewhere they need to hit a happy medium in there and quit spending all our money and just throwing it away here and there, as far as most of us are concerned.
Yeah, I would.
I know I'm not that well versed on how to spend that many millions of dollars either, you know. But it seems like it's kind of crazy to be spending it in one area trying to produce off of that country, when you're paying a lot of other farmers somewhere another over the country not to produce.
Yeah, well, I would understand it to be a rule, if you're running the country, that it's complex.
Oh, certainly.
But I would still think that just how you have to run your house and your own life, that it's got to be on that same, you know, it's that same equivalent. You got to hit that happy thing. If you do, like, so much here with horses, and so much here with cattle, and so much here with the greenhouse, and so much here with, let's say, baling hay or something.
That's right.
Then you got to balance it all out. And some years it'll be good for you to do hay, and some years it'll be, well, help. It's costing you money to go and bale that hay or work that hay
That's right.
You know? So sometimes you got to pull back, and sometimes you got to push forward on something. And it would seem to me that the national economy's got to be the same way.
Yes.
It's got to be that way. And you just, like I remember I was reading, I'd gone and done some work in Maine. And they just killed all the farmers up in Maine, all the chicken farmers and all the people that had small ranches, just squashed them, because a couple of big companies came in and were taken over. Mm-hmm. About 10, 15 years later, it became too expensive for the, 10, 15 years yep. later, it became too expensive for those two companies worked there, they pulled out.
That's right.
Now, not only did the guys not have any of the stuff anymore, because they had to sell everything, you know, to get it going, they didn't have a job anymore. Right. And what were they going to do? Because you know what it's like if you were to buy all the equipment that you have in this ranch from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm trying to say? You'd never do it.
Sure.
And these guys had to liquidate everything because they were changing. They thought, well, you know, they'll work down the factory, then they'll get to be retirement. A lot of those guys were in their 50s, man, and they were dead in the water.
Right.
There was nothing to do.
That's right.
So that's, I mean, it's one thing to say about your, you know, it's got to be a healthy economy that competes. It's another thing to say, well, everybody's got to be independent and work for themselves, and it's another thing to shaft somebody, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's
yes,
just,
yes.
That's just common sense.
With your ranchers here, and especially, you know, in this area here in Florida, I graduated from high school right here in Sarasota in 55. And the way that things have grown, I've seen several ranches that have now houses all over in subdivision just because of the increase in value of the property, and there's just no way that they could produce what it was going to bring them. And so eventually, this whole area that where we're standing right now, there will be houses here.
I don't know where these people are coming from. You know, I mean, I don't understand what they're
Chicago.
Doing. Well, Chicago and all them places, but you know.
But, no, it's just, we were changed, and as time forces us to change, we always have, and we will keep right on doing it. The rancher will keep right on doing it. Those that want to keep the land, they will find ways with better grasses, whatever, to produce more off of a smaller piece of ground. And so we're, in fact, on our little 160 acres we've got right here, we're in the process of doing exactly that right now. Some of the grasses that is here, it's a real good grass, but it just does not produce enough tonnage per acre. So for the amount of cattle that we could possibly run on here, if we change our grasses, then we can double the amount of cattle. So on 160 acres, we would therefore be double the amount of production that was, say, good here in the 50s and 60s was superb. But now it's the bottom of the list, you know, because of the tonnage that you're able to produce off of that ground out on grass.
Now, you can't see us, but we're standing there. It's just like a little pond, little lake right near us here. What is the kind of water around here, I mean, for this area? Is there good water around here, generally speaking?
Yes, sir, as a rule, it's pretty decent, like everywhere else. It'll get awfully dry, you know, but
yeah,
then it'll come along and rain, and it, but we're very fortunate with our piece of property here. We've got one nice pond area right here, and then running right through the center of our property, we've got a low slough type area that goes through there. And when it's dry, it's superb feeding because it's heavy muck land. And when it's wet, then the sand land on each side of it, then it's still got a lot of grass growing on it, you know. So it balances out real well. And now, of course, the further south in this state that you go, then those wet years really can get into a rancher because the ground is so flat down there, the water has no place to run off, and it's sour, the grass is growing there.
Yeah.
But for us up here, we don't have that kind of problem.
Does it get, how hot does it get when it's really here in the summer? Can it grow things, or is it just too oppressive?
Oh, no, sir. The grass just, if you get any, normally then when it's that hot, you go and get summer showers. And that's the two elements that you really need to make grass really grow is the heat and the moisture.
Mm-hmm.
And so, no, it just doesn't get too hot as far as we're concerned, really. I mean, it gets too hot to go out and comfortably work. But as far as the grass is growing and going, you know, it's going to produce that much more.
Well, I got to get back to work here. Let me just can I take a couple pictures of the whip by itself, and then I'll,
mm-hmm.
if I could ask you.
How would you?
I don't know. I don't.
The normal that most everyone understands a whip is coiled up, just like that.
All right. Would it be normally hanging up on a wall, or just on the? I guess I can't take a picture in there, actually.
Why don't we where you can see it?
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
find some place to...
Could you see what it looked like? That probably wouldn't show up laying stretched out there on the ground.
But that would...
On the trailer?
On the trailer?
That would give you a good idea of how one's supposed to be prepared.
Okay, whenever you're ready. Okay. You do another one on you? Okay, whenever you're ready. That was dope, man. Good job. That's a real problem. You see, you go around people who know how to do things. Mm-hmm. I'm watching people now, last couple weeks watching them, and every so often they've wanted me to try it, you know?
Right.
Hell no.
No, I wouldn't suggest that you
I stay away from
a lot
of that
right.
stuff, yeah.
I wouldn't suggest you try one of these cowboys.
Jimmy Tucker was kind of picking on me, you know? Mm-hmm. So he says, well, why don't you just make some of these hammers or
right.
try it, you know? So yeah. I did one, I did two, that's yeah. fine. Then he gave me this one, and was like, man, I couldn't
mm-hmm.
even get up off the floor.
16 pound hour.
And he just swinging her away. He's got no problem at all. Well, that's mm-hmm. fine, Jimmy. That's what you do all day long, you know?
That's right.
It's a different kind of thing.
It was real funny. I remember hearing Grandpa and them laughing whenever the first jet airplanes came out and broke the sound barriers. Well, all the news and everything that it made, and they was all laughing. And they said, well, we've been doing that for years and years, you know, with these cow whips. So we've been breaking the sound barrier with these cow whips. And never thought about it, but that is exactly what makes the thing crack and pop is whenever you break the sound barrier, you know.
Probably should let you go back to work here, Waller. Let me just, on that piece of paper I give you, let me just put my name on it.
Okay.
So you'll, in case you ever got to go back and reference.
Right. Talk to Mr. Geach Parsons.
Okay.
See me. You will certainly enjoy your day.
Okay.
The man has so much knowledge of our total history because that's... He is Florida. Mr. Geach Parton is, as far as I'm concerned, is Florida. The way he was brought up, the way he was raised, the way they've raised his children, and they're raising their grandchildren up almost identical. Of course, they've had to change like everybody
else. Yeah.
But he is can tell you the simple history of Florida as far as the cowboy and the ranching and stuff goes because he was there. He was raised up, and that man is... He's just the history of Florida.
How old
the
do you think
family.
Geach is now? Just guessing or something.
He's probably 74, I imagine, somewhere in there, 72, 74 years old. Yes. But he's one really super good cowman. In fact, they were, I believe, partners with the very first ones to ever bring a registered quarter horse in the state of Florida.
Oh, that was another thing I was going to ask you. Now, I've been reading various things, you know, and I the only thing I know about a cow is, you know, I like it with ketchup, you know.
Yeah, oh yeah.
You know, that's, to be honest with you, what sort of cattle, what kind of breeds are there around here? I mean, was there anything that was special to Florida? I mean, I know that the Spaniards let a whole bunch loose, and they're the wild ones and all that kind of stuff, but...
Right now, we have every breed there is, but virtually. I'm sure there's some from some very foreign countries or something that we don't have, but as far as your different breeds and crossbreeds and things, everybody is searching right now, trying to get a cow that will produce more meat on less grass and sell a calf quicker, you know. So we are all interbreeding and stuff, trying to come up and crossing up our what's termed as range cattle. And you go and you get all the different types of bulls. It's, you try this one and try that one. And for your particular place, what's working best for you, you know, because some herds just won't get along as good, say, here as they do, say, around the Ocala-Kissimmee area or something due to the natural elements that's in your pasture land. And but for the type of cattle, there's just every type you can name is right here in Florida.
Okay. Yeah, I saw some Brahman bulls.
Oh yeah, yes. Sir, we've there's getting away from too much of your straight Brahman. We have one out here in the pasture there now, and but the Brahman look to them, the feedlot people doesn't like them because of the hump, and it's hard to ever get one to finish out to a choice. They will, most of them will stay high standard to good when he's real fat. And it takes longer as a rule to get them up to that grade. So therefore, us making the rancher then go to something that will benefit the feedlot people, because that's who's going to buy most of your yearlings, is to produce them out for beef. And so they've, a lot of them have gone, of course, with their range cows and crossed Hereford bulls on them to come up with what's called Brayford cattle. And then some have gone right now and bought an awful lot of Beefmaster bulls, that we have one of those, and put out with their cattle. There's one rancher down here, Grady Millard works for, Longinos, and he said, well, after they changed over to Beefmaster bulls, it averaged like 30 pounds per calf when they was weaning the calves off to the previous years of before they had that type of bull. So, of course, now they're heavy into their Beefmaster bulls because they're just producing more off of the same pasture land that they had before. But there's just a number of different types of breeds that's doing the same thing for Florida, and that's what we were talking about a while ago, that the rancher is very versatile and he will learn to survive even though the taxes go up and all the rest of this normal stuff. He's going to find a better grass, he's going to run more cattle on there, and he's going to have a breed on there of some sort that will produce more pounds than what we had even say 10 years ago. It has changed drastically even in the last 10 years.
Well, you know, I was thinking about this a while ago when you were saying how, you know, there must be a peak like anything else, you know, where the land can only do so much, there can only be so much grass, the cattle can only do so much. I mean, does it, obviously everybody's going to look for as best they can, you know, with their area, and that's just natural, that's just human. But do you think there's any much more that they can get beyond? I mean, isn't there going to be a peak where they can't, you know what I'm saying?
Well, we thought that at one time back in the 50s whenever we came out with Bahia grasses for our area down here, said, boy, this is the ultimate thing. And then along comes Pangola grass. Boy, that could just produce just three times as much tonnage, seemed like, off the same pasture land. Man, we've reached it again. And now they've got grasses out right now that is just outgrowing that 2-to-1, you know. But of course, it takes more fertilizer to get more grass. And but I don't know when that we would say be reached a peak. I'm sure that we will sometime or another, but then again, with the technology that we do have today, we're going to find some way or another to go to another peak somewhere higher, and out of just pure survival, we will have to. We will learn to get along with, again, with smaller acreage and produce more off of it. It's going to be hard, and a lot of us will quit other than to keep going into it, basically because we won't have the finances behind us in order to carry this on through. But there will be people that will keep right on producing. As a kid, when I was growing up, they used to figure somewhere like 10 to 15 acres, depending on the rough woods, per cow to run. And, of course, with that same type of pasture and stuff today, they've got, of course, there's no way you could survive it. And now we're down up here on this sandland, down, say, to 1 cow to 2 acres, where before it was 10 to 15 acres on the same pasture land, and by changing the grasses. Down on the muck land down around Belglade area down there, there are a lot of places that are running 2 to 3 cows per acre because of the growing off that muck land. You know, so we, as far as reaching highs and peaks of what you can be able to produce off of there, somebody will find a grass or something, crossbred, hybrid grasses, that get them now to where in a 24-hour period they'll probably grow 1 inch or 2 inches if the right growing season and stuff. You know, so we'll find another peak somewhere down the road. They'll have to be.
Yeah. Well, there's one good thing about this job. You know what that is, Walter?
What's that?
I get to meet people like you.
Thank you very much. Enjoyed it.
Yes, sir. It's been my pleasure.